I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Achtung Millwall supports the Lions Food Hub. This is a friendly local food hub. It's based in Bermondsey. It's run by our very own Kelly Webster of the Mill Lionesses, a very well-known Millwall fan. They do need supplies, dear listeners. Before we get into the show today, I have posted they need tinned meat, they need toiletries, they need soup, they need tinned fruit and veg. If you can help in any way, they are on Twitter, at Lions Food Hub. DM them. You can DM me at Achtung Millwall and I'll pass on any help and information that we can. Lions Food Hub, at Lions Food Hub. Thank you for listening. Now back to the show.
You're listening to Achtung Millwall, broadcasting from the beautiful South Birmingham. Accept no substitute.
Well, hello, dear listeners. Welcome to Achtung Millwall, another special edition, one inspired by an article that I read recently by my very welcome guest to tonight's show, Mr. Neil Andrews. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Ochai the new.
A terrific article, if I might praise my good friend and guest tonight, on the lack of, the incredible lack of Scottish caps for Millwall players over the 130 plus years of Millwall's existence. It was an article written, I think it was Nutmeg, which I think is like a fanzine style, a quality fanzine. Neil, how would you describe Nutmeg magazine?
It's a Scottish football magazine. It's a periodical. So those of you that know Daniel Gray, who's a writer, he's had quite a few books, not only on football, on other things as well. He kind of took over this publication in Scotland. So it's along, if anyone knows the Blizzard or, you know, these football times, etc. It's similar to that, but in Scotland. So it focuses solely on Scottish football.
It's a great article, if I might praise it again. Mac Millwall, I think you titled it. Did it go with that title in the end? Was it Mac Millwall?
It was Mill. Yeah, they actually chose the title based on the Sun headline of when we signed Hartley Crawford, Jason Dare, and
Mac Millwall, famously.
And Sinclair,
I thought I'd go for the really original one of great Scots for tonight's show, listeners. I'm kind of mashing this up slightly as a consequence to Neil's article regarding the lack of Scottish caps for Lions since formation, 1885, with a kind of follow-on to the show I did the other day with Harry about the international caps for international performances for Millwall players over the years, and obviously the recent tremendous achievement for Jimmy Abdou and his Comoros Islanders, who have won their way into the first African Cup of Nations in 2022. And it just amazed me then. It amazed me when I read Neil's article that we have so few Scottish caps. So I thought it'd be great, Neil, to try and balance out the recognition of the contribution of Scots to Millwall Football Club over the 130 plus years since we formed on the Isle of Dogs in 1885. And I thought, just as a way to start a conversation, it might be good just to touch on the opening paragraphs of your article, where you deal with the there's always this glib throwaway remark that Millwall were founded by Scotsmen, and it's partly true, isn't it? Partly true, rather than being a complete truth, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, very heavily Scottish influence. So although it was a mixture of nationalities, it was basically formed, there's a guy called Duncan Heen, whose brother travelled down from Dundee with a guy called Patrick Houlihan, if I remember rightly. And they were kind of the drivers behind the football club because they were working at Morton's, which wasn't a jam factory. It's partly jam, but what they did was tins for sailing ships, actually. They kind of preserved the food
A cannery. Things like, yeah.
Yeah. So if anyone's been watching The Terror, it's the food that kind of gave them lead poisoning. Yeah, they used to do the tins for that. Mm-hmm. So they had initially there was a Mill Rovers bicycle club, which Patrick O'Hoon had founded, but they were very kind of sporty. And there was a works team called Iona, which is where Millwall kind of came from. And that folded. They kind of went to, you know, they kind of basically went to the company and said, you know, we're getting better in our kind of practice sessions. Do you mind if we form this club and go from there? So they were using kind of like the factory grounds during breaks to kind of have training sessions, etc. And so Patrick O'Hoon and the bicycle club actually gave Millwall the name. But the kit of Iona was dark blue because of the Scotland thing, and they kept the kit. So the main founders were all Scottish. So the main driving forces, like the first secretary, things like that. And then Morton's used to hire a lot of Scotsmen from Aberdeen and Dundee, etc., because they had factories up there. And basically they wanted the workforce up there who were used to doing this work to come to London. And so obviously it was a natural fit that they would then play football for Millwall. So it wasn't just the first generations. No. It went on from there. And one of the things, the first club secretary was recruited to play for Ireland, as they were then known.
This is Dr. Murray Leslie, if memory.
Yeah,
memory
and says, so that's where it comes from, that it wasn't just Scotsmen, but Murray Leslie was actually a Scot. So he was born in the Highlands and never actually played for Ireland. It's a myth. Okay. So if you go into, you know, the Rothmans yearbook, you can't actually find him, and no one's ever actually found. But he, funnily enough, he never played for Millwall either. So whether he could actually play football is a moot point anyway. But yeah,
like all great myths, they come from some truth somewhere. But
So what they used to do as well, they used to kind of when Mill was established, they used to go back to Scotland. They used to put ads in newspapers and kind of offer jobs that weren't really jobs in the old kind of like professional era.
Yeah,
and so people would technically get jobs at Morton's, but they were kind of got the jobs so they could play for Mill.
Nod. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very similar to the system that prevailed in East Germany and many of the Iron Curtain nations prior to the 89. I mean, there they had what they called shamateurism, I think, in the old days. But similar kind of idea. You had a job with Morton's, but you were really here to for your footballing skills and to promote Mill Rovers and Mill Athletic. But certainly, I think it's a truth that the club was very powerfully influenced by Scottish players, Scottish influences, the club colours, the lion rampant in its various designs.
Well, the lion didn't come till later.
Not early.
No, so okay. I think that's where the Lions of the South came from. So they had this motto of, you know, it was a newspaper kind of article, and, you know, lions were always a certain kind of animal that was associated with, you know, bravery, etc. And during the cup run, they had this lions thing, but that's where that come from. So the original badge just said MFC on it. There were no lions or MRFC, as it were. It's kind of Rovers. But that came later. But the badge that they then chose was the James I heraldic badge of Scotland anyway, the one like you see the Red Lion pub.
Yeah.
So there is a connection there, but it's not necessarily the same connection, if that makes sense.
It's a great article, as I say. If you do subscribe to Nutmeg, do have a look at it. It's well worth a read. The sad truth, listeners, is that we've only ever had one Scottish cap in the 130 plus years, 5 years, 3 years since formation. And that was one Jordan Archer, Neil, in a 2-0 loss against Peru in Lima in 2018. He took a bit of flack for his goalkeeping that night as well, didn't he?
He did, slightly unfairly.
Story of his career.
Really, yeah. So, the first goal was kind of because he kind of rushed out, had a mad rush of blood. He didn't actually give away the penalty. It was another player who handballed it. And he almost did save the penalty, but straight after half-time, he got harshly judged for a goal that was kind of, you know, a snapshot in the six-yard box, as it were. But again, he wasn't really at the height of his powers. He'd been in the Scotland squad a number of times and was always on the bench and never really given a chance. And then Scotland had this kind of end of season tour to South America. And ironically, I think that was the first time they played Peru since the 1978 World Cup. And so it was the end of that season where, you know, he was making all those mistakes. So it wasn't his height kind of thing. So it was weird that Alec McLeish actually gave him a cap then rather than earlier on in his career, to be honest.
One of the things that struck me, and I wanted to ask for your views, obviously you're a Scottish fan and Millwall fan, But one thing that leaps out of me with the story of Scottish football, if you like, is, and many younger listeners now, anyone really born since maybe, I don't know, has come to football consciousness since the 1990s, perhaps, won't have realised the sheer power and depth of Scottish football traditionally. You know, I'm thinking back to the 1970s, and I was trying to come up reasons why Millwall players may not have intruded on the Scottish squad. There may be complex reasons for that, but I've thought one of them was that the Scottish team was often a mirror image of the very highest clubs at the top of the first division. I'm thinking of the Leeds, the Liverpools, the Manchester Uniteds, and so on. Millwall players, obviously coming from second, third division levels, often wouldn't have got close to the Scottish team traditionally because Scotland was a power. Is that a fair assessment in your eyes? Would that be a good call, or is that oversimplifying it?
No, there are more complex reasons, actually. So kind of before the First World War, the Scottish FA refused to pick anyone who wasn't playing in Scotland. So we had quite a few players who joined Millwall, as you know, as we described from the ads kind of thing, who represented the Scottish League, etc. And, you know, one of the first games at the Den was the Southern League versus the Scottish League. And they were chosen for that reason, because of the Scottish connections. But they had a number of players who, you know, played the odd cap. But as soon as they moved to England, they were no longer considered.
Persona non grata at that point, as you cross the border,
And this actually continued quite a while until, I think, England thrashed them 5-0 for the, I think it was the third or fourth win on the trot for England. And, you know, people were saying, because they, you know, they were only selecting these teams. So to get around this, the Scottish FA chose what was known as Anglo-Scots. And so they used to have a practice match or a kind of selection match.
The trials game.
And they had Anglo-Scots versus the, you know, the home-based Scots. And I think the Anglo-Scots, won quite convincingly. And so next time they played England, they won. And it went from there. You had kind of like the Wembley Wizards and that. Who won 5-1, that famous victory, etc. But you're right. Come early 70s, you know, you did, you know, you had Peter Lorimer, who died the other week. You know, you had Billy Bremner, you had Danny McGrain, you obviously had Kenny Dalglish, who actually wasn't at his height. Well, he was at his height at club level, but, you know, it's always been the jury's out on his Scotland career, but at Scotland, he used to, I mean, the 1974 World Cup, for example, he actually played in midfield. He didn't play up front, but, you know, you had people like Dennis Law, you had, you know, Ian St. John's, etc. You know, you had some very strong teams, you know, but we almost did get someone when we almost signed Alan Ruff in 1978, but decided to go with Pat Cuff instead. So I don't know whether that was the right move or the wrong move, to be honest with you, but yeah. Even Alan Ruff, although he's got this reputation in England, mainly from the 1978 World Cup.
Yeah.
He was actually a decent keeper, but people always remember Peru. And they remember a certain free kick where he actually got his hand to it. But, you know, the main fault was Lou Macari in the wall ducking because it was going straight to his head. And he always says, you know, no one ever gives him any jip. I always get the blame. But I think it's because he had that ridiculous perm as well.
There we are. That's it was so near and so far for Scotland, in certainly in the 70s and the late 70s, 78 World Cup particularly. Some great performances and then some less great performances, I think, probably is the best way to put it. But certainly the modern era has been unkind on Scottish fortunes, really. Now, I mean, the rise of the Premier League, I think, has not helped the Scottish game north of the border. I mean, you've got obviously the problems at Rangers, the two great powerhouses, Celtic and Rangers. Rangers have fallen into hard times, maybe just making a comeback now. It may be that there's a little bit more competition, but it's a tough league in some ways because you have these giants of the game dominating everything, and then, you know, lesser lights quite quickly as you go down through the league table there. There's always been a talk of Rangers and Celtic joining the Premier League. I'm not sure it's ever really had any legs. I'm not sure the Premier League would particularly want it. Would you agree that that would be a strengthening move for Scottish football? I'm not so sure, personally.
Not anymore. I mean, if you talk early 90s, early 2000s, you know, Rangers were dominant. You know, they were beating English clubs. Celtic were the same. But the trouble was, you know, a lot of it is down to the Scottish FA. And, you know, everyone thinks the English FA is a bit backward thinking. They should try Scotland, you know. There were other issues as well. You know, there's, you know, lost a huge generation to various social issues, etc.
You know,
you read the stories and the talented players that went off, dabble with heroin or form bands. It was either one of the two, wasn't it?
But
the grassroots game up there as well. It's like it was only recently started getting, things like the 4G pitches and stuff like that. But the way it's very insular. It's still part time in the lower leagues. And the simple truth is, you could actually earn more playing football in Gibraltar than you can in Scotland.
Wow, quite something, isn't it? I was quite interested to see our own Danny McNamara go north to St Johnstone, and now I think we've sent James Brown up in as Danny Mac's come back down. James Brown's gone up there. It was interesting to see it maybe for the first time in a long while, where you go to Scotland to improve your game. I think that was quite an interesting development. I have no axe to grind on this. I enjoy Scottish matters generally. It's nice to see the game developing up there. The strong Scottish game traditionally meant there's a strong English game as well, as part of the same coin.
Go back to the 70s, for example. Everyone had kind of like a Scottish club.
Every great club had a Scottish spine, didn't they? You look at all the champion sides,
It used to make a friend of mine who I went on the old Mesa tours with, he used to laugh that I used to like Alloa Athletic. And the only reason I picked Alloa Athletic as a child was the shoot Lucky Ladders. Okay. And they had the orange on black. And it just, I don't know, it drew me to it because it was so different to everything else.
I have seen Queen's Park in Hampden Park when it was being rebuilt. Half of the stadium was missing. It was a strange experience. I think they're playing Cowden Beath. So you had this part... half of a world-class stadium, the other half was like open to a car park over the back, with what was in truth was a park level game being played in this kind of bizarre arena on one of the, I think they call it Drake, I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly. It was like a misty rain. It was as cold as you can imagine. And it was, I'm glad I went there. I'm not sure I'd want to go back too often, but it was a wonderful experience to say you've seen Queen's Park in Hampden Park, because I think they've had to move out now. They've gone to almost like an open field next door to it. It doesn't hold many.
It was mainly because of the running costs they did that, because Queen's Park, I think the last traditional, they refused to go full-time.
Yeah, amateur. But, they owned Hampden Park, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. That's where Andy Robinson started, funny enough. He's a good example, him and Kieran Tierney, of players actually, playing at the top level again in the English leagues. Part of the problem was, you remember the generation like Gazza, Chris Woods, etc., that went to Rangers.
Yeah.
So people stopped buying Scottish players because they were too expensive. It's like when clubs stopped buying Championship players because they got too expensive, because the asking price got ridiculous because everyone knew the money in the Premier League, which kind of opened the influx of all the foreigners. It's not worked out well for either English or Scottish football, but it was because players were so expensive, wages were so expensive, etc. And then Rangers and Celtic got into a problem where they were trying to compete with the Premiership sides. And that's backfired on them. So the saying went that for every £5 Celtic borrowed, Rangers borrowed 10, which is why they ended up in trouble.
Wonderful pies they sell in Scottish grounds, incidentally. I don't know what's in them, and I don't probably want to know what's in the Scottish pie, but they are beautiful things.
Scotch pie, you can't beat Scotch pie.
Scotch pie, and on that cold, cold day in Glasgow, it was certainly warmed me up, I can tell you that much. The reason for Neil and I speaking tonight, though, listeners, is to try and redress something of the Millwall balance. As I said, we call this show Great Scots because we've both chosen our respective arbitrary choices, perhaps, of great Scots players who've turned out for the Lions over the years. I've got my three. Shall I start off with my first choice, Neil, and then we can alternate? Would that be a good way to do this?
Yeah, go on, start off with your number three.
I'm going to go for John Gilchrist as my number three, I think, because he's one of the lesser-known names, and yet he was a major part of the early 60s Millwall side, including the team that went for 59 games unbeaten at home across Division 3 and Division 4. He made 317 appearances for Lions. He was a defender, right back, and played between 1960-61, 1968-69, 317 times for Lions, scoring 10 goals in that time. And I think I mean, I've never, it's before my time, listeners. So I'm going by the evidence that I've found on online. I think he would be described as rugged in his play. A real Millwall right back, the kind that you would want to see get stuck in. I found a £50 fine for John Gilchrist from Daily Mirror in June 1966. Censured by the FA Disciplinary Committee for striking a Grimsby player in a third division match played on May the 28th. So he got fined £50 for chinning a Grimsby player. And then there's another report in dated December. This is actually from the Coventry paper, the Evening Telegraph. A referee, Eamon Dunphy, Irish, was being disciplined for using abusive language to a referee. But the report mentions John Gilchrist too, the Mill defender, for tackling an opponent, Neil, in a vicious manner. This was the official citation. Tackling in a vicious manner. In view of the player's previous record of misconduct, the committee decided that Gilchrist must be suspended for 7 days. That's my kind of fallback. I think that's...
I was going to say, people rave about Tony Craig, but he never did any of that. He never made the Daily Mirror for being fined, did he?
No, I mean, it was a wonderful report. I did put it on Twitter earlier on, listeners, and you probably may have seen it, but it's a report from the actual record-breaking game where we took the record of 55 games unbeaten. It was against Ipswich in the November of 1966. And it describes players almost open fist fights on the pitch in the course of this 1-0 victory over Ipswich and it being a bad temper. I think only one person got booked. It was a very different world in the sense of physical play there. But I think John Gilchrist, 317 appearances over the course of the 1960s. His last games were in the 68-69 season when he would move on to Fulham and then to Colchester United. Before management at Tunbridge Angels. Quite not bad record of honours. He's got runner-up with Millwall in the third division in 1955-66. He was a fourth division winner with the Lions in 61-62. And then he won another runners-up medal with Colchester in 1964-65. And one for the purists out there, he would win the Watney Cup with Colchester in 1971. Passed away, born in 1939, he passed away sadly in 1991, aged 51. I think that's a player worth mentioning, and I'm glad of the opportunity with these little shows, listeners, to mention some names that probably don't get mentioned too often. John Gilchrist, RIP, I'd say he's a real character. Born in Wishaw in Scotland in 1939.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Achtung, Mehlball. Who's your choice then, in that case, Daniel? Who would you go for?
So my third choice may surprise a few people. It's not Jordan Archer. It's Hugh Curran. Who only spent just over a season at Millwall.
Okay.
He was so good up front that someone bought him. So he actually played alongside John Gilchrist. And I'll put my reason in why I picked him over some other more obvious choices. So he was Man United apprentice, got released, played for Lanark, then went to Corby Town, and then he was spotted by Millwall and turned professional in 64. And he only played one full season and got 19 goals, was the club's leading scorer as we won promotion from the fourth tier in 65. And he moved to Norwich City the following
January. Just say Norwich. I remember him being a Norwich player as a kid.
So he scored 26 goals in, well, these are league goals, in 57 appearances. So he had a great goal scoring record.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he carried that on a bit with Norwich and was eventually capped by Scotland. So in 1969. Played five times, scored once against England. I know, that's probably why I picked him. But one of the reasons why I picked him, because when he was at Wolves, he played in the UEFA Cup final against Tottenham.
That's where so, I remember the name. Yeah, 72, 73, something like that.
71, 72 when they, 71, 72. Yeah, when they lost to Tottenham. But so when you think about it, there's not many former Millwall players that have gone on to play in a European final.
No.
Not that many actually Scots. I was going to say Scots players, but Scotsmen who play for Millwall who've actually gone on to be capped by Scotland either. So he is actually in a unique group of one, I think, of Scottish players who have played for Millwall, played in Europe, and been capped by Scotland.
What season was he at Millwall for, Neil?
He was there 64 to 66. So he joined March 1964 and he left in January 66. So just under 2 years he was at Millwall. But he had a great goal scoring record while he was there. Like I said, leading goal scorer when we got promotion from the fourth tier. Played alongside John Kilchrist, funny enough. But it's all about not what they also gave to Millwall, but what they also achieved in the game. And the fact he went on to appear in the UEFA Cup final.
I agree.
Definitely deserves a mention and probably often overlooked as one of our great strikers, funny enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because as time passes, these names become, they fade, sadly, and unless you make an effort. One of the reasons why I try and do these shows, listeners, is to just to find names from the past that have, I don't know if they've forgotten, Neil, but they're not in the forefront of people's minds nowadays. No. I think it's a shame.
I think it's a shame when you got someone who scores 26 goals in 56 games. People go on about Neil Ruddock, who played 10 games for Millwall and is considered a legend.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's ridiculous.
I agree. So Hugh Curran, great choice by Neil. So I'm going to go to my second choice now. Which one should I go for? I'll go for Billy Neil. I'll go for Billy Neil, who would also feature strangely in the Hugh Curran side and the John Gilchrist side. A legendary figure in many respects at Millwall Football Club. He's been around for as long as I have been a Millwall fan. I remember he would have been playing just about, I think it was at the end of his career, 1971-72. Yeah, he was a substitute for one game in that season. I do remember seeing W. Neil in the match day programme for that season. That was my first season as a Millwall fan. And ever since then, he's been employed at the club. He would manage the ticket office, all sorts of stuff. He's done kind of office duties. Even to this day, he's still officially listed on the club website as the kind of, I think he is the liaison for the former players. So I don't know how onerous those duties are, in all honesty. It looks like it may be just an honorary position in some ways. But Billy Neil has been involved at Millwall Football Club basically and since 1963 and arguably to this day. He's born in 1944, he's age 76 now, born in a place called Rosslyn in Scotland. And apart from brief period playing for a club called Bonnyrigg Rose Athletic in 1964, he would make 187 appearances for the Lions 1964-72, scoring 23 goals. And as I say, he was involved in the unbeaten run. He was part of Benny Fenton's kind of late 60s development of the side that would go so close in 71-72, though Billy's career was probably coming towards its conclusion by that stage. But to have been involved with Millwall Football Club since 1964 and still so now, he's got promotions with us in 65-66. Fourth division, second place promotion, 64-65. He's in the Millwall Hall of Fame and he won a Football League Unsung Hero Award in 2012-13. The Sponsors Lounge at the Den is named after him. There's an article on the official site if anyone wants to have a look. It's refers to his devoted 50 years service. This was in 2014 that this piece was written. 76 years old now. I think that's an incredible life, actually. I mean, for someone to be devoted to Mill to that level, it quite takes my breath away, Mill.
Yeah. It's the old thing, isn't it? People become attached to a club. Yeah. And there's been many that are attached to Millwall, funny enough, hasn't there, down the years? But, you know, Billy Neil was a funny one in that outsider who's become firmly entrenched in Millwall folklore, as it were. He's kind of like part of the furniture.
Yeah, absolutely. A winger in his day. He's mentioned in a game, in the final game that where we actually lost the unbeaten run in 1967, and also one where we played Spurs. The report that was in the I think it's the Sunday Mirror was very anti-Mill, written by a journalist called Sam Leach, who was predicting that Spurs will slaughter these Lions that have just got beat 2-1 by Plymouth to end that unbeaten run. Billy would have played in that game, as mentioned in the course of the report. And a week or two later, we were due to play Tottenham in the FA Cup. And we were going to get slaughtered, according to Sam Leach. He made one or two snipey little remarks about Mill in the course of his report. And, of course, we wouldn't get slaughtered at all. It's one of the great titanic struggles of the late 60s between Millwall and Tottenham Hotspur. I think we drew 0-0 at a Den in front of an immense crowd, 30-odd thousand, I think. And then at Coldblow Lane, which would be quite something. If anyone's ever wondered what it would be like to be in Coldblow Lane, you've never been. Well, believe me, 20,000 felt like you were, you know, shoulder to shoulder. 30,000, I don't know what that would have been like. And then we played a return game, which we did lose 1-0. To a Tottenham team that included Jimmy Greaves and Dave Mackay and some other great names, and that was played in front of 40,000+. So we didn't get slaughtered at all, Mr. Sam Leach of the Sunday Mirror. And Billy was part of that team. So Billy is my second choice of great Scotsmen that have played for Millwall, Neil. So that's Billy Neil and John Gilchrist so far for me. Who's your second choice, mate?
Probably another slightly controversial one. Again, it's not Jordan Archer. It's Paul Hartley.
Okay.
So, one of the original McMillwall four, yeah, who came from Raith Rovers, funny enough. Not Raith Rovers, actually. He came from Hamilton Academicals. He actually joined Raith Rovers, ironically, after Millwall. But he joined with the other three. But he was the one everyone was impressed with that season. You know, I think he had a great season on the wing for Millwall. And again, I know he was only there a season, but the reason why I chose him was because of what he went on to achieve in the national team, funny enough. So he earned 25 Scotland caps, and he actually was capped under 21 when he was at Millwall. So there is the connection there. Mm. But, you know, we've had obviously quite a lot of Scottish players who, you know, who've made an impact at Millwall. But again, it's ain't making an impact because nearly 25 years later, people still remember those four Scotsmen and people still talk highly about Paul Hartley, which just goes to show the impact he made. But one of the reasons was because when he played for Scotland, he used to play in this holding midfielder role.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what, it sounds weird. World-class would probably be an exaggeration, but he played so well in that role that he, you know, he's arguably one of the best I've seen in that role. He was like, he also grew a beard at the same time. So he's like a Scottish Gattuso, if you remember him. He was exactly the same, exactly playing in a very similar position. And arguably his best match was when we won in Paris 1-0 during the Euro 2008 qualifying.
Yep.
Because he played this holding midfield role and he was absolutely immense. You know, he was breaking up the French attacks. You know, he was diving in everywhere and, you know, really upsetting their passage of play. But he always played like that for Scotland. He just played, he was immense for Scotland, funny enough.
He played more on the wing for us, Neil, didn't he?
He did. He played on the wing.
An artist kind of on the wings.
He was a fast winger. Yeah. But obviously as he got older, he moved into this midfield role.
More centred. Yeah.
And after that performance, Gordon Strachan started using him in a similar role for Celtic. And, you know, very successful. Yeah, I know it was Scottish football, etc. And to be successful with Celtic, it's harder not to be, if that makes sense. But it was his performance against them, Italy. You know, he was immense for Scotland for a number of years. And again, it's like what he achieved as a player in the Scotland team, as well as what he achieved at Millwall. And like I said, may only been there a season, but really memorable.
He had impact.
In fact, yeah, exactly, spot on. You know, people remember Tam Brighton for the wrong reasons, that he was always out injured for 2 weeks. But, you know, he basically put in a shift, and he was the only one of the four. You know, you could say the jury was always out on Steve Crawford, but he was the one who did turn up and did play and did look impressive on the wing.
Yeah, I mean, those were difficult days, let's be honest. Millwall fans, late 90s were not, mid to late 90s were difficult times. Jimmy Nicol. I think I'm going to agree with Paul Hartley. He was an illumination in a dark time in the club. And, you know, there wasn't much else to get excited about. And he did have that kind of, well, as I said earlier on, he was an artist on the wing. And that was a very welcome relief in what was otherwise quite tough times to follow the lines. And Crawford, I quite like Crawford. I know what you mean. Some people seem to take against him. Who's the other one? It was Sinclair. Who's the other one? There was the
Jason Dare.
Jason Dare. Yeah. So let's not speak of Jason
Dyer.
Jason Dyer and Davey Sinclair.
Yeah.
But Crawford and Hartley were two good players, and I'm gonna go with that choice. I like that choice. I'm probably going for more rugged, or maybe now I'm the most obvious choice of the lot, dear listeners, because my third choice is Mr. Alexander Scott Ray. A wonderful, wonderful midfielder in the early 90s. Alex Ray, what can we say about him? He came to us on the back end of the first division days. I think he signed for us when we were back in the second division under Bruce Rioch. A magnificent midfielder. Younger listeners don't appreciate, in my opinion, how good Alex Ray was. He was a dynamo in midfield. He could shoot. He broke play up. He was as committed a midfielder as I have seen. One of my favourite all-time players, Neil. I will go a long way to watch Alex Ray in his prime. And you can find quite a bit of material on YouTube. I was looking just prior to Neil and I speaking tonight at the wonderful 6-1 win over Brentford. It's just one example. There's others you can find on Alex Rainey's pomp. Some great, great performances. Played 241 appearances in all competitions for the Lions from 1991 season. Left us 95-96, which was obviously the collapse of the club, largely speaking. 241 total appearances, 15 as a sub, 71 goals. What we would give, Neil Andrews, for Alex Ray in our midfield right now. Magnificent player. I don't know how else to describe it. Obviously, would go on to join Sunderland and Wolves, and to some success. He'd play in the Premier League for both clubs. Both would be promoted at various points to the top flight. And rightly so, because he was a Premier League player.
He was one of the few players that when he never played, you noticed it in Milwaukee.
Yeah, you would cross the road and go a long way to watch Alex Ray play football. And I think that's always the mark for me of a great player. You know, as you just said there, do you notice when they're not there? Yes, you would notice when Alex Ray wasn't in the team. I picked out the Brentford game. I'm sure there's footage of the Sheffield Wednesday games, the 4-2 and 4-4. Have a look. It's well worth it. He would go on to play back in Scotland with Rangers and Dundee, and eventually, strange, all the places to finish your footballing career, finished at Milton Keynes Dons. And that's a strange little way to finish it, just three times for them. 585 league appearances, 114 goals. He played for the Scottish under-21s nine times. Never at the top flyer. Did he ever get capped for Scotland? They're not listed on here.
No, he did. He was never capped.
Strange.
Got one of you beat internationals when at Millwall. I think it's under-21s as well.
Yeah.
And Mick McCarthy used to question why he was never capped. But there was running issues, I think, with...
lifestyle, I think.
Yeah, there were lifestyles, and Craig Brown didn't like him or didn't fancy him. I think there was lifestyle issues there, should we say.
He's now patron of the Sporting Chance charity.
Rehabilitation.
And, I take my hat off to anyone that deals with their demons, shall we say, and that's what Alex did.
And I've also got a signed Alex Ray Scotland shirt. From someone up in Scotland who knew I like Millwall, got me aside Alex Rayshirt. But yeah, he was a fantastic player. That first season when Sheringham hit all those goals, we knew we'd unearthed a gem from Falkirk.
Falkirk, that's right.
But, you know, he played so well. It was hard to wonder how he never got a cap. I mean, to be fair, it was quite a strong Scotland side at the time, but, you know, that doesn't mean you don't get the odd cap or even a corrupt. You know,
it would need to be some midfield to keep Alex Rayet on a regular basis, because in his pomp, he was some player. Who knows what other things might have intruded on that decision making? I don't know. Certainly a little bit of management, not so successful in management. He worked with Paul Ince at MK Dons and managed at Dundee and St Mirren. Still immensely popular, Neil. You still see Alex Rayet engaging with Mill fans online. He's a very affable, very popular bloke. And one of my favourite all-time Mill players. I make no bones about it. He was a great, great player. And
And you got him because I knew you'd struggle with three Scottish players for Mill.
I've got a few by the ways, but we'll get your third one now. Come on,
I thought I'd give you the obvious choice to make it easier for you.
Thank you. Yeah. So you're number three.
Technically my number one. It would have been Alex Ray. Yes. So it's not controversial.
Okay.
I gave you Alex Ray. That's fine. I can live with it because my one is arguably one of the best Millwall goalkeepers ever. And as everyone knows, my fascination with goalkeepers, and he's Scottish. Yeah. And no, it's not Jordan Arthur again.
No.
No, it's Malcolm Finlayson. Or Finlayson, however you want to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And it's quite weird that when people talk about Millwall goalkeepers, and we've had a fair few down our time who were half decent, should we say, he is never mentioned. Yet he is probably, arguably, one of our most successful goalkeepers ever post-Millwall. He's definitely better than Alex Stepney, which may cause some to tear their hair out.
Some will tear their hair out.
I think Bob Asprey will be tearing his hair out if he had any left now. he's always going on to me about Alex Stepney. But he's a good case of being Mill's best goalkeeper. But again, because when he played, he doesn't get the same mention as some. But his record does speak for itself, you know.
It's just the same. Finlayson joined Millwall in 1948, so he's going back to the post-war era. Difficult times for Millwall listeners. The club had been heavily damaged during both physically and also in terms of playing staff by the Second World War. Malcolm Finlayson joined us in 1948. 230 appearances on Wikipedia, Neil.
Yeah.
Up to 1956.
This is interesting. He left school at 14 to work in the Clydeside shipyards.
Okay.
So he wasn't allowed to play football anymore because, you know, his parents couldn't keep him in full-time education. But he joined a club called Renfrew Juniors. So junior football up in Scotland was quite strong back then. And he had trials with Celtic and Dumbarton. But because he was only quite young, I think he was 16 when trials in, they wouldn't take a chance. But Mill invited him down. I think February 1948, played against Charlton in a friendly, and they signed him on the spot. And he was only 17. And he went straight into the first team. We got relegated that season, but that wasn't his fault. You know, it's already, you know, already on a downward slide, as it were. But the following season, he was very famous game against Walsall, which some people may know about.
Right.
That he ended up in hospital after diving at the feet of an opposition player. They took him to hospital. When they returned to the ground of the club, the gates were locked, and they climbed over. So the club official climbed over and let him in. Yeah. And Jimmy Constantine had taken over in goal.
Okay.
And Millwall were losing 3-1. But inspired by his return and dedication to the cause, they won 6-5.
6-5. Made a 3-1 to come back to win it 6-5.
Yeah.
You go to hospital, you come back to the ground. Listen, have a think about that. It's different, isn't it?
But he's another thing to mention. He did play over 250 appearances, should we say. But it would have been a lot higher, but he had to do national service as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of robbed him of a few things. And so obviously with his reputation, his performances, etc. This is where another reason why, not only did he do it for Millwall, but he did it at a high level as well. So several top flight clubs are after him, including Chelwell. And he signed for Wolves, who bought him as a kind of replacement for Bert Williams, the England goalkeeper.
Right.
And he eventually won the battle and became Wolves goalkeeper in that formidable size of the late 50s, where, you know, they beat people like Real Madrid in, you know, in those games.
The big floodlit games.
Yeah, which kind of spurred on the kind of European Cup kind of thing.
I'm just looking at his honours here, Neil. I mean, you know, with Wolves.
This was his honour. He won the title twice in a row with
Football League
Wolves.
Champion, yeah.
Yeah, and I think he only let in 47 goals when they won it in 57-58. Right. They defended their title. But then the following season, they almost did double. This was the thing. So they won the FA Cup. They beat Blackburn 3-0. That was the one, I think, when Whelan broke his leg, that famous final.
Oh, right, yeah.
They won the FA Cup, but on the last day of the season, they lost, and no one expected it, and Burnley pipped them to a third successive triumph. So he was a goalkeeper that almost won the title three times on the spin and almost became a double-winning goalkeeper as well in the same season, which was unheard of.
FA Cup winner in 1960, that had been that season, 59-60.
But despite this, Scotland never picked him because he was playing in England.
That's short-sighted. It's beyond the realm.
You've got a goalkeeper playing with Wolves, strongest team in Europe. You know, almost three titles on the spin, FA Cup, and they wouldn't pick him because he was playing in England. So
well, there we are. This
in 58, they took a goalkeeper. What was his name? Fred something from Aberdeen.
Right.
You know, it was.
I went to the World Cup with him instead.
Yeah, it was near retirement, and it's like it's baffling. Scottish FA are sometimes baffling in their decision making, and this is one good example where, you know, you got someone like Malcolm Finlayson winning the league, etc., and you don't get picked.
Wonderful stuff. Malcolm Finlayson, 1930, born in a town called Alexandria, not in Egypt but in Scotland. Passed away in 2014, aged 84. Goalkeeper, great choice. RIP, league champion with Wolves twice, FA Cup winner with Wolves in 1960. That's a great choice. I like that, Neil. And I like it. It's not so obvious. And again, another name that many won't be aware of. And they, you know, it's nice to be able to bring these names to their attention. I went for a by the way, it was a tough choice between one or two of my choices, and Alex Jardine. I just want to mention Alex Jardine, if I may, who was a defender who played in the 1950s with the Lions. He played for 299 fixtures, appearances for the Lions, 25 goals, 1950 to 58, before he would return to Dundee in the... No, he started at Dundee, apologies, the other way around. Started at Dundee and came to Millwall, made 299 appearances. Passed away in 1978, aged 52, quite young. That's comparatively young, born in 1926. He represented the Third Division South. I didn't realise this until I did some research just before the show. Alex Jardine was Millwall's defender during his early 50s period, and he played as a Third Division South representative in 1954. Through to 1956-57 seasons, and he retired in 58 due to an Achilles tendon injury.
I mean, we had quite a few players in the 50s from Scotland.
Yeah.
You know, when we were down amongst the dead men, as it were. Yes. So they don't quite get not the accolades as such, but they were, you know, some of these players made over 100 appearances, but you wouldn't know. And, you know, unless you did your kind of research. Because, you know, in the modern era, I think from the 70s onwards, you remember names, or, you know, people remember names, but the names from the 50s and 60s are slowly being forgotten, like the names from the 20s and 30s, which is a great shame.
It's a shame. They become history, don't they? It's, I suppose, for everyone, you know, the years before you were born are ancient history, and I think it's becoming further and further away now. You know, it's nice to be able to just shine a light into some parts of the club's history that isn't so well known. I mean, one thing, just talking about Alex Jardine and the early down among the dead men, third division South years, what struck me was there was one season, I think it was 52-53, where we came second in the third division South. But the structure of the game then was such that you had to be champions to get promoted. Only the champions left the third division South or North. So to come second with a really good performance, and this would have included Jardine and one or two others, obviously, you know, the game was loaded against you, wasn't it? I mean, to come second and not get any reward for that seems very strange from, yeah, the modern perspective.
It does, but you know, that's the fascinating thing, isn't it, about, you know, football. So, you know, we can go, you know, you look through, you know, the 70s and the 80s, you know, you had, was it Alan McKenna, the youth team player?
Yeah,
the 79-78 season, you know, a youth team player from Scotland, that's kind of unheard of. Then you're like, you move into like a strange era when most of the Scottish players we got were kind of like loanees, or, you know, we had that season after. Eddie Sheringham, where we had John McGinley, we had John Colquhoun as well, who both were great players, both played for Scotland. But
funny enough, he's on my by the way list, John Colquhoun, because I liked him. I mean, I couldn't justify him being in my list of greats because he only played 27 times. But part of this is a totally arbitrary thing, Neil. So I thought I'd throw in players that I just liked, you know.
He never really suited our style of play, did we? And another one as well was John McGlashan.
Yeah.
He came as a youngster, started to do good things, then picked up that nasty injury and sadly died quite young as well.
Yes, he did. That took me aback when I read that. I'd lost track of my... I once paid for some petrol in a Kidbrook petrol station, and John McGlashan was in front of me wearing his Millwall gear. And I don't know why this conversation, I suppose, A, it was John McGlashan, and he was completely getting out in a Millwall shell suit. And he was trying to buy a copy of the Daily Record, Scottish Daily Record, in this Kidbrook petrol station Sunday night. And the guy behind the till was saying, "That's a Scottish paper, mate. You don't want to be reading that. There's, you know, there's the Daily Mirror there." So he said, "Yeah, I want this because it's I am Scottish." And I just remember this strange conversation about he wanted the Scottish Daily Record. He wasn't buying it by mistake.
The stories go, it's not quite up there when the day I met Pele, but I'll give it.
it's my little brush with stardom, John McGlashan in the petrol station.
Started doing good things, but, you know, then got a really nasty injury and, you know, just carved out a career in lower league Scottish football.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you had people like Mark Laird, who, you know...
Good player, yeah, I liked him.
The thing I liked about Mark Laird is that he's my favourite anecdote for putting down AFC Wimbledon.
I was going to top my petrol station story.
No, when we played them in the FA Cup and we beat them 4-1.
Yeah.
But... That was when they scored and all their fans got excited. And then we went and scored two more goals just to shut them up in the last 5 minutes. But they took this free kick and Mark Laird was the only one in the wall. And it was about 30 yards out. Mark Laird was not the fattest of players, was he?
No, he was skinny.
Yeah.
Beanpole.
Only person in the wall. And what did this player do? He hit Mark Laird dead on. It's all like, how the hell did you manage that? But we've had quite a few. Colin Cameron was on loan, wasn't he?
Cameron,
We had that other goalkeeper whose name escapes me. He played in the UEFA Cup final. What was his name?
Remember him. Rab
Douglas.
Rab Douglas, yeah.
Rab Douglas was on loan. Don Hutchinson, of course.
One of my favourite Scots, and I mean, I've got a list here, I won't go through them all, but one that I did like from the early 90s, from the Bruce Rioch times, was John McGinley.
So I said him early, didn't I?
Great striker. He left us, didn't he?
Thrown out with the bathwater by Mick McCarthy. And went on to great things at Bolton.
Laurie Leslie, who was coach when I started going, but he was a goalkeeper.
Laurie Leslie was the
West Ham, I think.
But we won't mention that one. But he was a decent goalkeeper.
Peter Sweeney. I don't know how Scottish Peter Sweeney really was, but he did qualify for Scotland, didn't he?
He was born in Glasgow.
Was he?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
There's James Henry, who we discussed.
James Henry.
Qualified for Scotland.
And played for England as well in the under 16, 17. Yeah. And finally, I want to give a shout out to my favourite Scot in the current scene, Murray Wallace. I love Murray Wallace. I think for a player that will give you everything he's got to give. I mean, look at that performance when he came back from injury recently. You know, hadn't trained. I think Rowett said that he'd come straight in pretty much on one training session, having recovered from injury over a few months. And he came in and gave you a very, very professional, committed performance. He must be an immensely fit bloke. And I know he has his limitations, listeners, but I just like, he's a very Millwall player, Murray Wallace.
I don't get this. What is it? What are his limitations? That's what I read online. He has his limitations.
Well,
what do you want from your fullback? Admittedly, Kieran Tierney set up three for Scotland the other night. But what do you really want from your centre-half stroke?
Well, his comparison would be Scott Malone, who gives you pace and control and some kind of probably a higher level. I mean, you're talking about quality is up
there. Two different players, really. Scott Malone is a wing-back.
But I mean, Murray being asked to be a wing-back is probably where these limitations might come out.
But you say that, and if you go back and watch the games he played earlier this year and early last year, some of the balls he played, think, my God, that looks like a clogger. But he was playing superb balls with the outside of his right foot, his left foot. And people go on about his pace, but I can't remember anyone beating him or skinning him too much.
He doesn't want for fitness, I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
I think there's a big place in the game for giving 100% every game, and that's what Murray Wallace does. I take your point.
Interesting because, you know, people say Kieran Tierney and Andrew Robinson can't play for Scotland together, and they've proven they can. And it's the same with Murray Wallace and Malone. So I don't know if anyone's listening, i.e. Rowett, but if you put him on the left-hand side of the back three, and then you've got Malone bombing up and down, and you've got Murray Wallace overlapping, I'll tell you what, we'll be mid-table before you know it.
I wonder if Rowett does. I can't imagine he does, listening in the bath to you and me prattle on a great Scotsman of your history.
I doubt it very much, but then he doesn't know what he's missing.
I will forgive Murray Wallace anything for that goal against Everton, that last late goal against Everton.
I think that was the thing. People were kind of, I don't know, jury was kind of out on him until he scored that. But I'll tell you what, I really like our back three. Murray, Wallace, Cooper and Hutchinson.
That's a committed Millwall back three.
Got their faults, but I'll tell you what, they are actually all quite decent players. But if they're off, one of them's off their game and they make the mistake, it's obvious they've made a mistake. The number of times they haven't made a mistake, you know, you can count them on, you know, one hand, as it were. But, you know, it is a very, very good and a very strong back three. And I think it's something you don't notice until one of them's missing. So Alex Pearce, you know, I think his legs have gone. I think everyone's agreed with that.
That's consensus opinion. I don't think there's any dispute over that.
Gave a good season. But, you know, when Wallace was injured, yes, Malone came in, but Malone's a different player. You know, you do notice that kind of hole. And I think you'd notice a hole if you missed Cooper. Well, we did when Cooper was injured as well. But, you know, it's a very, very solid back three.
Great stuff.
If only they could, you know, also play up front and in midfield, we'll be unbeatable.
Score a few goals, perhaps. There we are. It's been great speaking to you, Neil. Thank you for your input and your research into these great Scots of Millwall history. It's been good, good conversation, I think.
Do you know, it's a great shame Alan roughed it and signed, isn't it? we could have had so many of these on Alan Ruff.
I want to bring back John McGinley up front. I don't know if he's still got it, but anyway, there we are.
Yeah.
Huge thank you to Neil Andrews. It's been a wonderful show. Great talking to you, mate. And we'll do something very similar soon. I fancy another one. I'm mulling over a few other ideas, but I'll give you a shout on those.
We can mention how Neil Harris qualified for Scotland then as well.
Yeah, that's another kind of, I don't know if it's an urban myth. Did he qualify? Did he?
He did. It was his granddad or something like that. But he committed to England, yeah.
Well, that worked out well, didn't it?
Fool that he was. He could have had some great near misses with Scotland.
Neil Andrews, thank you very much. And it's arrivederci Mill from Neil Andrews and myself, Nick Hart. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Aston Millwall. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a cheeky little review. Arrivederci Millwall. Till next time.
Who do you want to watch?
'Chavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball. It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.